Hi, I'm Amy Blackthorne, and this is The Blackthorne Grove, a podcast where witchcraft meets with good friends over tea to talk about the nature of magic and community. Today, we're going to be talking about grief. So, if this is a little too sensitive for you today, please feel free to come back. We're not going anywhere. We'll be here for you when you come back. So, today, I have an incredible panel of guests to talk about the nature of grief, how we process grief as witches in our community, how we discuss it. And at the end, we'll have some resources for those who are finding themselves in grief and aren't really sure how to process that or deal with those feelings. So today we'll start with Lulu. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello, my name is Lulu. I am the owner of the Salem Plant Witch based out of Salem, Massachusetts. And I am a facilitator for a local bereavement group for witches.
Fantastic. Martellus.
Hi, I'm Martellus, author of Do I Have to Wear Black? Rituals, Customs, and Funerary Etiquette for Modern Pagans, and The Bones Fall in a Spiral, a Necromantic Primer. I'm a mortician and funeral director, and my whole life is death, so
Thank you so much for being here. Courtney.
hi, I'm Courtney Weber, and I'm the author of a number of books. Most recently, Hecate, Goddess of Witches, and the forthcoming Sacred Tears, A Witch's Guide to Grief. I am a witch, a tarot advisor, and a guide for the magically minded.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us. Those of you who have not met me yet, I'm Amy Blackthorne. I'm the author of seven currently books on witchcraft, depending on everything from social media to the realm of magic and plants. And I'm thank you so much for everyone being here today and being able to make it. The first thing I want to start with is how do we define grief? It feels like a great big subject, and we've really got to narrow it down to make sure that everybody's on the same page. Lulu, how do you define grief?
So there is an expression or a phrase, I guess, that I heard after I lost my own husband several years ago, and it was talking about how grief is love where with nowhere else to go, which I think is pretty, I think, spot on for the feelings and the kind of the complications that come around the loss of place emotionally.
Well said. Thank you so much. More tell us, how do we define grief?
Oh gosh, I'm also very fond of that particular quote, "Grief is love with nowhere to go." Jamie Anderson is who that quote is from. But I think that grief for me is sort of how it's tangled up in how we define bereavement, right? Bereavement comes from this old Germanic word, berephian, which means to have something taken from you. Sort of implies that grief and bereavement are sort of an act of violence against the individual. It's something lost, something taken. And while we do center that around love, I think that depending on the kind of grief we're experiencing, it can feel like an act of violence. So it's sort of tangled up in those kinds of trauma feelings as well.
Absolutely. Courtney, how do we define grief?
For me, it's a natural reaction that mammals have to loss or separation. And it comes in a variety of shapes, sizes, textures, and colors, flavors, and all of that. It's complicated, and it ultimately changes the person who experiences it.
Absolutely. There's always going to be this before after dichotomy of around big losses. You think of yourself and your time with that person and that connection that you have, the relationship that you've had, and there's the after. And it doesn't extend just to people we know. There's also grief of so many types. Lulu, what is the most common grief that you're dealing with in the group that you're leading?
So, a conversation that we've had a couple of times has been really around the idea of like complicated grief and how that is like a term that a lot of us have heard therapeutically. And I think you could call it like the absurdity of calling grief itself complicated because it is by nature of itself a complicated feeling. So it's there's a lot of talk around the idea of how just how complicated it is and how it almost feels redundant to call it that. And it talks about we talk a lot about just the interconnectedness of grief and how it affects just different areas of our life and how it can become all-encompassing as a result of that.
Absolutely. Mortellus, are you experiencing one kind of grief more than another in your community work?
I would definitely say disenfranchised grief, which is sort of defined as a type of grief that people don't feel allowed to feel. So this might be grief for an individual you don't know, like so many of us experienced when Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, or grief for a pet or companion animal, which somehow feels inappropriate in our society, or the loss of something intangible, like a piece of art being destroyed. These types of disenfranchised grief are around us all the time, and people don't really know where to put them. So they can become really traumatic in that we're carrying them around all the time, trying to sort of figure out what box to put them in. And I see it quite a bit.
Courtney, when you're talking about your book, Sacred Tears, what is the most often type of grief that you're dealing with?
I've seen a lot of varieties. It's been mostly people are very vocal about the grief when someone passes away, because that's a grief that doesn't require a lot of explanation. What has also been coming is grief that people aren't as encouraged to either acknowledge or talk about, grief when a friendship falls apart. You mentioned when a pet dies, that's very real grief that if that doesn't get taken as seriously as it could be argued that it should be taken. And also just kind of this nebulous grief of our world being very, very different and rapidly changing and having a hard time putting a finger on it. I've experienced that, through when I'm reading for people or in discussions that people have had in preparation for the forthcoming book.
It's very interesting the things that we don't really allow ourselves to grieve or don't feel entitled to grieve with, say a coven disbanding is a very specific kind
Yes.
of grief in our community, and people do not understand it who haven't experienced it.
Yeah, and
Yeah.
it makes me very sad, and it's I don't know if it's something that's if this is a cultural thing or this is just kind of cultural and that it's like contemporary for Western approach, but or if it's just the ponds that I swim in. I left my coven a number of years ago, and I thought that things were fine, but a couple of years later, a number of former members came forward with some very hurtful and factually untrue things. Like, I didn't say or do those things. You got plenty of other things you can criticize me for. Why don't you go with things that did happen? But at telling people that I felt sad about what happened, there'd be a lot of, well, what do you care what they think? Instead of it's say, well, they're not really your friends, so just let it go. It's but there was a time when I really loved these people and was we were all very much invested in each other's lives. And to see the side of them is deeply hurtful, deeply painful. And that kind of grief can get brushed aside pretty quickly. Like, well, they're just who cares? They're just former friends. And that the loss of a friendship is a deeply painful one, especially when you've been in spiritual space with them for so long. And it's like, wow, that's how you see me, that hurts.
Absolutely. You were looking at such an interconnected and enmeshed relationships with these people. They, because we're a minority religion and people aren't really used to things like churches closing down without no notice or warning, there really isn't a comparison for people outside our communities to really understand and get how upsetting that can be. In our communities, there can be some toxic positivity when people are confronted with grief, especially if you're talking about something like the loss of a coven or the loss of a, those friendships and those relationships. Lulu, how do you see the impact of toxic positivity in a place like Salem?
I think, like generally speaking, at least in our community, there is a lot of emphasis on the idea of like love and light, which translates to spiritual bypassing and cutting out a lot of the more complicated core emotional experiences that are part of being a spiritual being and part of being human. And toxic positivity really just, I feel you it undercuts a lot of the important emotional and spiritual work that needs to happen when you're going through periods of transition, especially like emotionally and socially, things like that.
Absolutely. Or tell us, how do you deal with those very real feelings when someone comes through with some toxic positivity in relation to their recent loss?
I don't know. I think that those kinds of feelings are often baked into these cultural ideas of Christianity, right? Even when we aren't Christian, we've been around this kind of stuff so much that it's there all the time. And those are the kind of it's the kind of spiritual language we're used to hearing around death. They're in a better place and that sort of stuff. And I think that kind of positivity, especially in grief spaces, can be really harmful because it steps outside of everyone's individual ideas about the afterlife and culture and that sort of thing, and puts people in a place where they have to just sort of accept what dialogue is being handed to them, right? Like, we don't feel very empowered to say that isn't something that makes us comfortable when somebody is saying things like that to us when we're grieving. So how do we deal with it? I think we have to have that dialogue every day so that people who are grieving don't have to have that dialogue.
Yes, absolutely. It's very hard to help people understand that it's not the job of the grieving to school everyone around them. Thank
Absolutely.
you.
That's why I have a whole chapter in my book about how to support somebody who's grieving and what not to say.
Bless you. Do you have an example that you'd like to share?
So similar to what much more Tella said is that the Christian hegemony, whether or not we're raised Christian, tends to infect our a lot of the ways that we communicate and support each other. And a lot of times witches and pagans unwittingly repeat the same things that Christians say. So instead of it's in God's hands, they say the uni it's like it's the will of the universe or it's meant to be. Or they're in a better place, they'll always be with you. And that's not helpful when, I mean, when a friend of mine passed away from cancer when her son had just turned 18, it's like, I don't believe that she's in a better place. She wants to see her son grow. Like, he grew up, but she wants to see him graduate college and start a business and if he wants to get married, she wants to be there for all of that. So how could you say that she's in a better place? And also, so it's, and I think where witches in particular have to be very, very careful. And I've made this mistake myself, and it's something I'm not going to do again. Is believing that you've got messages from the person that just passed on, and even if you do, the deceased per the bereaved person probably doesn't want to hear it from you, right? after my first miscarriage, I had somebody send me a Yule card that wished me and my husband and our spirit baby a happy Yule, and I was not okay with that.
No.
Right? And they thought they were doing the right thing because it's like, well, your spirit baby is always with you. It's like, that is not helpful. to me at all, because they're, if that's true, I would rather them be here, in my arms than hanging out on the other side. So, that's why witches in particular really need to be careful about, believing you've got some kind of spiritual insight about the person's loss. And I know there are cases when that might be true, but you've got to be very, very careful in how you present it. Because it's just absolutely excruciating for the person receiving that kind of quote unquote message, right? When they want nothing more than to be able to communicate with their de departed one, and here you are saying you have connection with them that they don't have. That's just awful. And a lot of times they're wrong. Like, not too long ago, a friend of mine from college passed away. We were in the theater department together, and somebody who listens to my podcast reached out and said, "Oh, I've got a message for you from him." And he's like, "Hey, girl," and made him sound like a drag queen. This guy was super hetero, never would have used the words, "Hey, girl," was not into glitter, was not into any of that. And I appreciated where that person was coming from. I'm like, that's not my friend. That's not how he talked. That's not what he said. That was you. And I get that you were trying to be kind to me, but that's not a message. That's you. And so I thank you so much, but that's not him.
I think it's sort of interesting, just speaking from the mortuary side of things, taking off my witch hat and putting on my mortician hat. We know in death care that people that come from communities and cultures that espouse magical thinking, that individuals in those communities actually grieve worse because they tend to spend so much time focusing on how they can communicate with the dead and still keep them in their lives that they don't spend a lot of time sitting with the idea that they are no longer sharing physical space with them and grieve just sort of mundanely. And I think that is definitely not helped by people like Courtney's talking about who keep bringing that back into your every day when you don't ask for it.
Absolutely. It's very concerning to me as an outside person when people feel it necessary to insert themselves into your grief as though they are grieving with you or alongside you. I lost my uncle in 2012, and I found out from CNN in the airport getting on the plane to fly to Canada. The family had barely been notified, and CNN is broadcasting details that no one should ever hear about their family. And the world, seeing that you're in grief, is not only terrifying, but it's really upsetting to have them think that they're entitled to be a part of your grief when they really have no place. I don't even know if that's a question, but if anyone has a comment to follow up, then feel free.
And I also want to offer some kind of compassion for people who are having real experiences with, the departed. One of the there mu there there's probably something on the other side that might prevent the recently deceased from contacting their closest people. And another good friend of mine from high school passed away. I've had a number of encounters with him since he passed. But I do not bring those up to his widow or his mother at all. What I do instead is I just say hi to them. When if I have a dream about him where we're talking about something, I might just pop into his mom or his widow to say, "How are you doing? I just want you to know I'm thinking about you." And that's all. And that way, if there is something that they need, that opportunity is there. But I don't say, "I had a dream about him last night. You want to hear what he said?" I don't say that at all. I just, and it also helps me communicate with my departed friend, like, "Hey, if you're worried about your people, they're fine. They've got people looking out for them. And, I'm here if they need to lend a hand. I'm not going to discuss our conversation. Just gonna let them know that they're on my mind." And, that's, and also recognize that him showing up is for me. It's not for them. He'll show up for them in a different way, right? And so it can be about my process and not like Amy, you so eloquently said, me inserting myself into their much deeper, more painful, more raw process of grief.
Thank you
Did I
so
make any
much.
sense just now?
Yes. Oh my God. Yes. Yes.
It's like, what do I do if this person has a message? Say hi to the person and be like, oh, I just want you to know I'm thinking about you. And if the work, there's a role for you there, that opens the door. Maybe there's not a role for you there. And you just, okay. And the worst thing that happens is the person knows that someone is thinking about them, and that's not a bad thing.
Absolutely. That's a really important distinction to make. My stepbrother completed suicide probably 10 years ago. And maybe 5 years after the loss, he popped up in the back seat of my car, like, oh hey, I feel really bad and I'm sorry and I hope dad's okay. Absolutely not. Am I going to show up in, on the front door and say, "Hey, I spoke to so and so." Absolutely not. That's it's my experience, and he can make his contact in his own way if he chooses to do so, but it's not our place.
In the worst, you could always write it, not saying you, Amy, but the collective you could always write it down and date it. And then if the conversation ever circles back around where that person comes to you and is like sharing a similar experience, you could say, okay, I'm gonna affirm what you're feeling because I had the same thing that happened. And here it is on paper and dated, so you know I'm not just making this up. But you gotta wait for that to come to you. You don't want to insert yourself.
Absolutely. Lulu, do you have something to add?
I think for a lot of people, when we find themselves in situations where they're kind of inserting themselves in other people's grief or experiences, is it probably ties a lot into just the lack of discourse around grief and loss in our society in general. And I think that trying to connect to other people's experiences is probably their attempt at being either helpful or, I guess you could say, just showing that they, in their own way, have some kind of level of understanding. And it does get complicated because in a lot of situations you find people doing that in what you could call inappropriate ways. So like when my husband passed away, it was people that he knew, years and years ago coming to me and telling me that they knew exactly how I felt because, they went to kindergarten with James. And they remember, being children with him, and it's a at its core a very different experience, but it was them in their way trying to connect themselves and connect with me in this in a situation that they probably didn't have a lot of experience navigating. And it was said earlier talking about how it's important to kind of be able to have these conversations and to normalize grief and loss as much as possible. And it's, I think, a learning curve more than anything else. And I don't think that people really go into this trying to hurt anyone's feelings, obviously, but it's basically based in an experience itself, if that made sense. It kind of came out a little muddled, but
Absolutely. Or tell us, in your experience, is the grief that's felt on the funerary end, do you see a lot more people that are drawn to it from a community standpoint of a community gathering, or has the pandemic really changed how and if the funerary process is actually happening? Does it change the grief that people are experiencing?
I mean, the pandemic affected so many areas of life, so it can't help but touch it. And sort of early on in the pandemic, particularly when we were really having to be careful about how many people gathered, that made funerals very hard. And we had bereaved individuals and funeral homes alike that were really antagonistic toward the idea of limiting how many people could attend a funeral. And it got really difficult after a point. I mean, we lost, gosh, something like half of the Black funeral directors in the country because we just could not keep people from wanting to have large funerals, not just in that community, but just generally, and it just impacted those smaller communities more painfully. But
Yeah.
in terms of how people interacted with grief, I think we saw people have to confront the fact that we sort of in the past had expended a lot of our energy on grief in the funeral services themselves, where that's sort of where we're allowed, right? We go to the viewing and we go to the funeral, and then you get a couple of weeks off work, and then you're supposed to be fine and go back to work and that sort of thing. And I think with the pandemic, we had so many people working from home that people had more time to sit in the quiet of their own grief, and in a lot of ways that was better for people, I think. But now we see people pushing more toward those intimate sort of grieving practices, which of course, society sort of pushes back against. We don't want to give people time to just exist and grieve and be. So that's an interesting dialogue I see happening.
Thank you so
Get back
much.
to work, make money, get
Yeah.
back to work, get back
Yeah.
to work.
That's sort of something I touched on in my first book, where I talk, particularly where I talk about pet death, where we know psychologically people grieve the loss of a companion animal the same as they grieve the loss of their own child, but and nobody bakes you a casserole and you don't get any time off work. Like, they laugh if you cry about losing a pet at your job, right? Like, you're not allowed to have that. So it's interesting to see these kinds of things.
The
I
words,
remember feeling,
go ahead.
I remember feeling so blessed that my job gave me a day off work when my cat died. They were like, you just take the day off, it's fine. And I'd be like, oh my God, these are the nicest people in the world. And really, truly, that is a very, very serious luxury that I had, that I could take a day off when my cat died. And, especially people that live alone when they lose an animal. That's just, it's just gut-wrenching.
Too, we don't really talk about the fact that that's kind of, for a lot of people, that's the first kind of grief we experience. That's like a child's primer in death, is losing a pet. And it can be so impactful to how we are shaped as human beings and how we interact with death and grief. And yet we don't even give that space to kids, which is terrible.
There's this outpouring of, I have to make it better. And so let's rush and get them a new pet, or let's rush and do this and rush and do that, instead of just allowing them to process these very real, very grown up emotions that can really affect children in the heart of who they are. That's such an important step for them to figure out, okay, how do I deal with these overwhelming feelings? When we talk about the stages of grief, there's these very neat little diagrams of steps, and they're each one that is labeled, and that's horseshit. It
Yeah,
just feels like you're stuck in the
I
middle of a
have to
tornado
speak
with steps are coming at you. Go ahead.
I have to speak to that, because much like the keys between the fingers, that's one of those things that quirks my eyebrow like a crazy person. So Kubler-Ross's method, the stages of grief, were written not for people who were grieving a death, but for people who were grieving being diagnosed with a terminal illness. And the study sort of centered around a very particular demographic, very particular in terms of like gender, class, race, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a really small pocket of people. And we know today it basically isn't taught in mortuary sciences anymore, because it doesn't fit people. Nobody grieves like that. You see people lean more on the Tonkin model, which was popularized by Elizabeth Tonkin, where the idea is that grief never changes. It's something you have to make space for in your life. Like, if your life was a mason jar and you have this extreme loss, the loss would fill it to the brim. And there's never less grief in the jar, but your life might grow to accommodate it. You become a bigger jar over time. You just sort of grow accustomed to the amount of grief that exists.
One of the things I talk about in my book is that grief is that if these experiences of grief, which exactly what Martella said, like even Kubler-Ross, like toward the end of her life, was so frustrated that her model was honestly misused and misunderstood. But if we do have some of those experiences of the shock, denial, anger, bargaining, they're almost more like points on a spiral, and you hit them as like, in a way that you're traveling around this orbit of your life, and periodically you're going to keep hitting these experiences. When I was in high school, I lost two friends in a car accident, and I'm 42 now, and I still sometimes trip over or bump into whatever you want to call it, or I hit those points in the spiral of grief over this loss. And you know that in the beginning, I think I had all those feelings, the shock, denial, you know, this can't be happening, this is weird, I don't believe this is happening, angry, crying. And you know, sometimes now, like even just a few years ago, I became angry about their loss because I was experiencing something in my life, and it's like those friends didn't get this far. They didn't get to have the hot mess dumpster fire moment that I'm having. And that's terrible. And I'm so mad about it. And how dare life take them away at 17 when they could be 35 making a huge mistake. You know, that's, you know, that was, and so it's like, but then I pass through it and then move on. And then at my high school reunion, I saw their permanently young faces, and I thought, you know, I'm, and I just threw a fit right there, like how upset I was and was sad. You know, so you find that as you travel along, they're part of your orbit, so to speak, and you're going to meet with them again. And then there would be times when they're not in your face, and they're not underfoot. But then they'll come back and they'll pass again.
It's funny how, for me as a mortician, it's like I spent so much time learning to be a grief counselor, and I've done hospice volunteering for, oh my gosh, nearly 20 years. I'm so old. Oh no. So you reach a point where it's like, I understand this and I know what to expect, and that's all tidy until it's your own life and your own loved ones. Very recently. Good gosh, almost exactly a month ago today, just slightly over a month, I found out that my father was dying of pancreatic cancer. And I'm estranged from my father. He was one of my primary abusers when I was a child. So my first instinct about this was to get angry and cry. I cried so much, but I was mad. This was rage, right? How dare they have the nerve to die when I'm not done being mad at them, and they haven't shown any remorse, right? You want something. There's always this space in you that wants to be filled up with whatever that shape is. About 2 weeks later, a dear friend of mine had an emergency room visit and found out she too had advanced pancreatic cancer. And she was told the same message my father was told, and she died 2 weeks later, and my father is still living. And even though that call could come while we're talking right now, but just sort of that anger of it's not fair that this wonderful young person with so much life to live got moments after that diagnosis, and then this sort of cruel, vitriolic elderly man just like keeps on going, right? Like grief isn't tidy, and like Courtney said, you're gonna bump into those walls with it where no matter how sort of whole and enlightened and thoughtful you feel you are about death or any topic, it's not going to always play nice with you.
Absolutely.
Grief is a little feral sometimes, I think.
That is probably the best
Grief is the
descriptor
little feral.
I've
I
ever
love it.
heard. There's our episode title right
Write
there.
that down. Grief, it's a little feral. That makes us to a really interesting topic. Our community, because we're sort of insular in our outward appearance, but we're obviously affected by the dominant religion of the country, Christianity. What are some of the taboos about grief that witches have that maybe our Christian friends may not understand? I'm gonna leave that open just because I don't want to pick anyone out in case they're
While Courtney and Lulu were thinking, I would take that moment to say that that's a little broad, just because what a witch is can be so variable, and our community can be so variable. So there would be very unique taboos to each group of people. So it's almost an unanswerable question in that kind of way.
I was hoping that abroad would be good, but I will absolutely move on if this is
No, it's fascinating. We think about taboos that we have. I think, with the kind of module of it's in Jesus's hands, I think that's certainly we as witches don't want to put any of our own, for lack of a better word, branding on it. Like, I am not going to tell Amy that her loss is in, Bridget's hands, because I don't know that that's what Amy believes. And so, and part of, or even if that Amy would believe that there'd be deities at all involved with this. So I would not, I think that's where we do stop short. But I think, but like I said earlier, we still tend to unwillingly parrot what the Christians say sometimes, where it's like, well, it's in the universe's hands. We just kind of replace Jesus with the universe. And the truth is, the universe doesn't give a fuck about us. The universe doesn't even know we exist, if the universe is a cognizant entity at all, right? So it's, that, or but so I think that's where our taboos, there is an understanding about our multitude of paths and identities and understandings. Yet there's still a tendency to do some of that same stuff.
Yeah, that was something I wrote about. And do I have to wear black too? And I teach, I basically go around and do consultations with funeral homes, teaching them how to be more open to other faith groups, pagan friendliness, I sometimes call it. And one of the first things I talk about is spiritual microaggressions, where we're saying things like, they're looking down from up above, or, like you said, they're in God's hands, or they're all of these little things where it's just you want to punch the other person in the teeth when they say them. It's just you're sick of it already.
If I
I
never
will.
hear they're in a better place as long as I live, it'll be too soon.
One of my least favorite is you'll see them again one day, and because that implies we're all hitting the same afterlife, right? It sort of erases reincarnation, it erases different afterlives. And it's such a little one, so familiar to us to say they'll be waiting for you, but.
I will say that I think being a witch, it gave me a little bit more, I think, wiggle room, you could call it, in my grief process, because I was going into it, with my own understanding of life and death and transitions and stuff like that. A big reason why we ended up starting the group in Salem for witches and bereavement is that a lot of the support groups and stuff that we were finding locally were geared through we'll say like a Christian-centric lens. And whereas that didn't necessarily fit for everybody, it being able to kind of congregate and work things out in our own way through an exchange of information has given a lot of, I think, comfort in the process of finding answers for ourselves. And I will say that I think from, again, being a practitioner of magic and a witch and myself, not having to lean as heavily back on the, we'll say like the Christian normativity of grief and loss. I mean, I started seeing like mediums and stuff pretty early into my grief journey with the loss of my husband. And I think that gave me a lot of comfort and answers that I wouldn't have been able to otherwise find. I think my first involvement with a medium was about 3 days after my husband died. That's how I ended up meeting Leanne Marama, who owns Pentagram in Salem. And she ended up doing a reading for me in which my husband and my father both came through at the same time. And that sort of, I think, gave me a really even place to stand going through like the funeral and the early grief stages, because it gave me the knowledge and the belief that they were together, and that they were at least, you know, in a place and in a situation where they could, you know, be there for me together, I guess is how I'm trying to put that. And I was in an interfaith marriage. So my husband was Catholic, my father was Catholic, and I have been a practitioner probably since I was about 14 or 15 years old. So it was nice to see that I could exist and find my own kind of belief system about loss parallel to that, because I know that they had their own shared beliefs. And I know that that was working. Sorry, I'm getting a little
It's okay. Take your time.
trying to think of how I want to phrase it. You know what I mean? Would we be okay to touch back on that so I can kind of.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Take whatever time you need.
I have that gives me a thought, if it's okay.
Yeah.
Leanne's lovely. I know Leanne, and there are exceptions to every rule, but I typically find it to be an ethical concern reading for someone who's really recently bereaved. And I typically won't do it unless it's someone I know very, very well and I know where they're at. Does anyone have thoughts on that reading, like the ethics of doing those kinds of readings for someone who, their loved one died only a couple days ago, for example?
I have a 6-month limit.
I'm
You
at
need.
three. Yeah.
Nice. I was going to ask.
Yeah, for me, it's a case-by-case basis. There was a young woman in my community who her father died, and they were immediately having a lot of experiences of him in the home, and they were trying to make sense of it. So I did go ahead and do a reading for them just to help her sort through the kinds of experiences that they were trying to get. Really, what it was her father trying to plan his own funeral. He was telling them exactly what he wanted, and she was worried that he didn't know he had died. I'm like, if he's planning his funeral, he knows. So don't you worry about that. He's passing on. He just wants a few things tied up first. It's for me, it depends on the person. If the person's just in absolutely raw rage, you know, open wound grief, I wait. And people reach a place of, for lack of a better word, kind of groundedness. And you know, at different places, some people are pretty solid and grounded in their ability to process and function shortly after a loss, and some people it takes years to get to a place where you're can be productive about this kind of messaging. And I hope that my language doesn't sound too clinical or harsh. I'm just trying to, you know, as somebody who's been through a lot of different kinds of grief, and you know, that kind of groundedness I can speak to from personal experience or not having it. And yeah.
I think I get where you're coming from, and just sort of on the mortician side of things, the more, clinical side of things. We do see that in the industry as well, particularly people who've anticipated a death. The person had cancer over a very long period of time or something like that, or the individual is very elderly. They knew it was coming. They were a little more seated in it. They were prepared. It wasn't sudden. But as is the nature of things, and I'm sure that's true for any of us here, if you have a shop or if you've written books, you're going to probably do readings for a lot of people we don't know very well. And I'm far more likely to agree to do a reading for the recently bereaved if I personally know them and know where they're at, than I would a stranger, because I can't assess enough about that person in a really short amount of time to know where they are. So I tend to draw bigger boundaries with someone I don't know very well, because I wouldn't want to be in a position to make someone grieve worse, you know.
And also for me, it's what they're asking. And I mentioned this story in a book as well, is that I was reading at an event in New York City many, many years ago. And so there was a lot of alcohol, a lot of music, a lot of really intense stimuli. And a young woman approached my table, and she told me her parents had been murdered. And she wanted to know why that had happened. And I did not answer that question for her. And I was kind of hard on myself for years for not answering that specific question. Instead, I changed it to what can let's look at what you can do to get yourself through this, and read that for her. And now I think that was the right choice because, given the environment, which was not a healing, supportive environment, it was a party environment, and also, it really so much so often. There isn't a why. Things are random and horrible, and that to me is a worse answer than there being any sort of structure to it. And it's just as likely that there was some kind of random person who caused this, not because they had a plan for it, it's just because it's what they did. And that could have been what the card said, that there was no reason for it. And that would have been a horrific thing for this grieving person to hear. And I was not going to deliver that message. And I also still think that was not the place for it either. Not at a drunken artist's event. So I told her, let's look at what you can do to help yourself with it. So that's also maybe, and it could, I don't know when her parents were killed. It could have been years before that, or it could have been 2 weeks before that. So for me, sometimes it's not always about the timeline, it's also what they're asking.
That's a great point. I mean, we're so used to hearing God has a plan. You know, to have the opportunity to ask someone why did this happen is really overwhelming. We ask ourselves when, you know, any big and sudden loss like that happens, and there often isn't an answer. Or if there is, it's can be more upsetting than the actual loss itself.
One thing that I think is worth bringing up when you're talking about grief, and maybe this is totally irrelevant to the conversation, but it's a bit of a soapbox for me. But in the 24 hours after a loss, your risk of a heart attack is increased 21 times. You were 21 times more likely to have a heart attack in that first day or two after losing someone that you love. That includes a pet, for the record. So for those of us who are around the grieved, and anyone listening, just sort of knowing that that's a risk for you and a risk for, you know, your loved one who might be experiencing a loss, and knowing what to look for can save other lives. So
Absolutely.
literally dying of a broken heart.
yes, and it's such a big thing that most funeral homes will have, we have paddles back there. Just in case. It happens all the time, people having heart attacks at the funeral.
This is an interesting timing that we've scheduled this a couple of weeks out, and it just so happens that there is a tragedy that's happened in Baltimore, where I'm born and raised and my family still lives. The one of the major arteries of Baltimore is the Baltimore Beltway, and part of it collapsed overnight. So we're dealing with a lot of disenfranchised grief and people sort of reaching out and trying to figure out what effect that has on them as a person. How can we look at disenfranchised grief for ourselves? What grace can we give to ourselves when we're experiencing something like that?
Well, I'm hearing this as, I think that what I would hear about in those situations is people saying, do I have a right to grieve this? Did it happen to me personally? I don't have a right to grieve because I wasn't personally affected. So I don't have as much of a right to grieve as somebody who's closer to it. And that's just not true, right? There's fear involved. The idea of a bridge collapsing is absolutely terrifying. You may have your own memories there. You may know of someone who was hurt or injured, or know of someone who knows someone. You have a right to grieve however grief comes to you. And what I encourage people to do is, and I'm forgetting the name of the woman who first coined it, maybe Martellus remembers this, or Lulu, you probably remember it as well. It's the comfort in, dump out model. who coined that? It's freaking brilliant. It's like in the center, it's like a circle, a bunch of rings, and in the center of the circle is the person who's most affected. So let's say, for example, using Amy's analogy, the bridge is collapsing. The people that are in the center are the ones who were directly impacted, either injured in the collapse or their spouse was injured or killed in the collapse. They're the ones that are the most affected. Now you have people who are one ring out from that. You have the siblings of the people who lost spouses. And then on the circle outside of that, you have the friends of the siblings of the people who are affected. So everybody's going to feel something on this because it's scary and it's horrifying. But you don't go to the person in the middle for your comfort over that, right? So the siblings of the person who's siblings of the bereaved are going to comfort the bereaved, but the siblings of the bereaved are going to seek their comfort from somebody one ring further out, their friends. And those friends who are having some feelings about it aren't going to seek comfort from the sibling. They're going to seek comfort from their coworkers who are still even one more ring removed. So you comfort in and you take your feelings and you dump outward. You don't seek comfort from the person who's closer to the situation than you are.
Courtney, you were thinking of Susan Silk and Barry
Yes.
I like that theory, and I do think it's important for anyone listening to know that you can give someone secondary trauma. So make sure you have good consent when you're dumping outward, right? You want to make sure that that person's in a good place to hear it and comfort you.
Absolutely. It's one of the best practices I've found is making sure that when you're talking to someone, they have the emotional bandwidth to hear what you have to say and to respond appropriately.
There.
Does anyone want to talk about any working with deity and grief? Is that something we want to talk about?
I did have a thought about the bridge collapse.
Please.
I'm always trying to look for maybe a different viewpoint or a different angle, and I understand this is an iconic bridge. It's probably someone's connection to people and connection to their jobs, and it means so much being able to move between places. But I know that there have been some suicides from that bridge, and I wonder what it feels like for families of those individuals to see that bridge fall. And I wonder if they're receiving some kind of comfort from that. So just an interesting side thought, maybe.
It definitely is, especially with it being an iconic bridge, and as far as the connection to the history of our country, it was where Francis Scott Key saw the visuals that inspired the Star Spangled Banner. And so there's not just a historical connection, but the idea of country and patriotism when it comes to those losses and how they can reflect on where our country is as a whole.
Exactly. And it is such a it's an unusual thing, and that comes back around to that disenfranchised grief, where grieving an object or an icon or a piece of art, it's a kind of grief we don't necessarily feel allowed to have, but it definitely is a real kind of grief, and there are definitely techniques for coping with it. So I hope people are finding good methods that work for them.
Do we have any final comments before we move on to resources for grief?
Not I, says the cat.
Okay. If there are any grief resources we'd like to share, especially the name and the full titles of the two books that we've discussed so far, would be great.
I'm sorry, I got a little bit cut out there. You want us to mention our books or books that we like? Oh, okay, yeah,
Both.
both. So one of the books that I really liked was a book called It's Okay That You're Not Okay, and I'm drawing a blank on the author's name, but I really liked that one. And my book is called Sacred Tears, A Witch's Guide to Grief. It will be out in June. It is available for pre-order now wherever you get your books.
Martellus.
My first book, Do I Have to Wear Black? rituals, customs, and funerary etiquette for modern pagans. It has a lot of different resources. And there are even some chapters in there with rituals and materials for coping with different types of bereavement. My newest book, The Bones Fall in a Spiral, talks about interacting with death from the magical side of things. So that could be interesting for those at a later stage in grief. Some of my favorite books for those who are dealing with loss or sort of struggling with ideas about mortality, neither of them are pagan books, but I really enjoy Advice for Future Corpses by Sally Tisdale. And I'm also very fond of The Worm at the Core. Both of those books sort of talk a lot about how we interact with death as a society, and I've always gotten a lot out of them, so I hope you will too.
Perfect, thank you. I do want to mention There's No Good Card for This, What to Say and Do When Life is Scary, Awful, and Unfair to the People You Love by Kelsey Crowe. Talks about grief and how to handle that as someone who is in that second or third ring, how to respond appropriately and the things that are helpful to hear when you're dealing with those losses and those feelings. I just want to thank everyone for coming by today and sharing their thoughts and feelings on the subject. I will put in the show notes how to contact each of our fabulous speakers, and I just really want to thank you for coming and participating in our panel today.
Thanks as always for having me, Amy. You're the
Absolutely, Dylan.
best.
You are also the best. We're it's
It's
twins.
nice to be mutual bests.
I really appreciate the discussion that we had today and the ability to talk about this in a public venue is really important, especially because we get to the point in our over culture that people don't feel that it's appropriate to talk about death or dying, and it's something that happens to all of us and it's important to discuss. So thank you very much for your time and attention today.
Thank you for having me, Amy. I hope everyone tolerated my jet-lagged self. I'm not the most fun today, but
I genuinely appreciate your being here, and Lulu as well. I just appreciate all of you, and I appreciate you me messaging you at whatever 2 o'clock in the morning to say, "Hey, we should talk about this."
yes.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful
Thank
day.
you.
Remember, we are all trees in the same grove. Nurture each other.
I love that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Amy.
Have a
Thank
great
you.
day. Bye.
Thanks, Amy.
Bye.
Bye.